Coming up next on the Witness the World podcast, the future of finance.
You don't want to be that old person, and not necessarily, you don't even need to be old, you know what I mean? It's like, you don't want to be that person that when the stuff comes out, it's like having to work a computer for the first time, or I don't know how to use a mobile, or I don't know how to access the internet. And I honestly believe that generative AI is that next step for us to sort of get to the point where we start interfacing with data in a real time.
The Witness the World podcast represents the personal views of the host and guests at the time of recording. These views may change over time. The content here is for informational and entertainment purposes only. Any content here should not be construed as financial, medical, or any other type of professional advice. Please consult with a qualified practitioner should you require any professional advice. Welcome to episode 11 of the Witness the World podcast. My name is Ben Choi, and today we'll be heading to South Africa. Our guest has been a corporate leader in the energy industry for many years before making a switch into technical stock trading. He's also a podcaster and an online magazine writer that covers the financial world. Today, we'll learn about his journey and how he helps educate others about all things finance. We'll also explore some ideas and approaches on how we can all create a more resilient financial future for ourselves. Rocco Striden, thanks for joining us today.
Ben, thank you so much for having me. It's only an honor and a privilege.
Thank you so much, Rocco. So I thought we start things off a little differently today and maybe ask you to share a little bit about what it's like living in South Africa these days.
What a curveball. It's interesting. I always say South Africa is a beautiful country. It's got the best of everything and it's got the worst of everything, right? Because it's sort of, If you go and look at the history of South Africa, where it comes from, the Dutch and the French basically colonized South Africa, right? So it's a Dutch-French colony. So we've got a lot of European history, but therefore we also have massive inequality. And up until 1994, we had something called apartheid, which was run by the old government, the old regime, where there was segregation between blacks and whites. So all those historical fault lines, right, weren't fixed post 94. We sort of just moved on, I guess. So now we're in a position where the chickens are coming home to roost. We are sitting with massive problems, infrastructural problems, high crime rates, but also you're sitting with massive wealth in mining and tourism and excellent healthcare. So when I tell people it's a great country to live in if you know how to live in it, if that makes sense.
Interesting. Yeah, thanks for that background there, Rocco. So in Canada here, some of the day-to-day challenges, so we'll fast forward to 2023 now, some of the day-to-day challenges we have where there's like living with like inflation, you know, there's a lot of issues with, you know, finding the supply shortages for certain goods. And in many industries, almost every industry, there's like a shortage of labor. Like we can't find enough, you know, people that want to work, or maybe the skills for the people to work. So is that the same in South Africa as well, from what you can tell?
No, we've got fairly There's been some brain drain out of the country going to Canada and Australia and Europe, but the skilled workers and unskilled workers are still here. But you're touching on a very interesting subject. It's something that Elon Musk talked about a while ago. It's this notion that the planet is actually not overpopulated, but that countries are sort of struggling with low birth rates, and countries like Japan, for instance, are actually in trouble because even if they start reproducing now at a factor of 2 to 3, they're not going to make up that lost population of, you know, young people that they need to go into the workforce. So it's interesting that you're saying that in Canada, that's already showing up.
Yeah, that's interesting. Like we got different challenges in Canada and the US. We kind of follow similar, not exactly the same challenges. And I hear that from other parts of the world. And that's interesting to note there. Other parts of the world got the brain drain, and whereas we just can't get enough. So interesting comments. So yeah, thanks, Rocco. So let's touch on your background a little bit here. So I noticed doing a little research on you that you've really established yourself in South Africa for some different jobs, careers, and kind of shifted over the years. So perhaps you can give our audience just a quick high-level overview of what you've worked on over the years and where you are now.
So don't want to bore anyone to death, so I'm going to run through this as quick as I can. Basically, I studied law, but I was new that I didn't want to become a lawyer, because there's this old saying that goes that a lawyer can never go into heaven, or can never get into heaven, because the good lawyers need to do what the normal person on the street is not sort of, you know, wants to do. So they make their money through like family law, which is a lot of divorces and stuff. So I just said, nah, that's just what I want to do. But I had the finance, I had the business, and I had the law. So I sort of everything, that's a very good footing. So I always, if someone asks me, what do I need to go and study or whatever, I always say business law. It's a very good, if you don't know what you want to go and do, right? So then my father and I found an energy company at the time in South Africa, coming out of that segregation period where the old government had control over all assets, right? There became this opportunities, you know, like in any country that so sort of the economy opens up, right? So the energy industry was one that started to attract more independence. So we basically started our own petroleum company, and I did that for 10 years. I sort of got involved in the energy trading side of everything. That's where my fascination with financial markets began, or my love with financial markets, because I started to learn about things like contango and of crude oil arbitrage and stuff like that. And talking about a lot to the oil trading guys. And then I'm like, ooh, okay, this is interesting. What else is there in trading? What else can I trade? And then I sort of discovered equities and commodities. And then I started to branch off into that and decided, hey, this is cool. This is hard. One of the hardest things you can do. People think it's easy. It's not. But then I sort of started to educate other people, and grew that into a media company, which has always been my love, has been for media. So yeah, that's a high level overview of me in energy, finance, and media.
Excellent. Yeah, thanks for the background, Rocco. So you're now doing some work with a podcast, the HGM podcast, Stonks Go Moon, if I recall correctly, and also NFT magazine you're writing there. So I'm just wondering, like, how do you get involved with writing for an online magazine? Do you apply for it, or like, how does that work?
So funny thing is, the Stonks Go Moon podcast it's sort of like a Monty Python-esque joke in itself, because it was at the height of the AMC and you know, all the meme stocks, like April 2021 I started the first episode, and My goal was really to shine a light on people that I felt didn't have a platform, right? Or they, it was conversations that I felt needed to happen at that stage, because there was just like a lot of noise and a lot of uncertainty in the market and people don't know what's going on. So I got all these professionals coming on. We started talking business, tech, and finance. That grew up until a point where you sort of start to get some notoriety and you get people saying, hey, I've got this person that I'm looking to book on your show, or I got this person, you know, do whatever. And that's how the writing opportunity came about, basically, because the editor has a PR company, and he basically just sent me over a couple of guys to interview if I wanted them, and I definitely wanted them. And then said, hey, I'm editor of this magazine. I'm being sort of appointed. Can you write crypto? And I said to him, I can write anything that you want. and so that's, I didn't apply for anything. And I think that's sort of the route that we are going since 2021, 2022. It's that whole networking, right? It's like it's because it used to be, oh, I apply for a job through a portal or a recruiter or whatever. And now it's more of like building your own brand, putting yourself out there, putting content out there, because like you're doing with your podcast, right? You're putting content out there. Everyone knows, who listens know who Ben is, who, what you stand for, and sort of what your viewpoints are. And it makes it easier for people to then find you and say, hey, here's opportunity. I think you'll be great for this. It's just a different setup from applying to 100 and hundreds of jobs, I guess, and not hearing back.
Excellent. Yeah, thanks for that story, Rocco. Yeah, I echo those sentiments as well. So, I mean, my podcast's very new right now, but I've had different people from all different walks of life just message me after a few episodes. So you're right. Organically, you keep, you know, putting yourself out there and doing what you do, what you love to do. And, you know, organically, you kind of attract the people that, you know, within the sphere that you want to attract. And it just kind of works out that way. So interesting how, yeah, you know, the connections are being made in 2023. So now I want to kind of touch on a little bit about more on the financial media world, which I guess you could say that you're in the throes of it now. So over the past 6 or 7 years, it could be said that there has been a battle going on about how do you determine what a trusted media source is for, whether it be current events, financial news, medical info, politics, or whatever, quite frankly. So I think we now kind of live in a world where if we want to be a more informed citizen, we have to take an even more critical view of these sources and really understand like the motivations and interests behind each of these types of media organization, whether it be a government sponsored media, corporate media, or even independent media to some degree. So I think it's important we seek out, you know, information that challenges our beliefs as much as possible, see multi-side layers of a particular story. Also, seeking confirmation bias, I don't think is really healthy. It might make us feel better to some degree, but so anyways, having said that, just wondering, like, what is your process to determine what a trusted media source is? Or is there such a thing? Maybe it just comes down to like a balance of probabilities that we can trust something to a certain degree, but you got to always leave yourself open to maybe that being incorrect down the road. And just wondering, what are your thoughts? Big topic here.
Whew, but it's kind of worms, right? Because damned if you do, damned if you don't. But one of my best examples and my favorite examples is a print of The Economist, I think, just before the COVID correction. Remember the COVID correction? 2008, okay. So it had a picture of bulls on it, like tech bulls. And it said tech's $2 trillion bull run. It's either $2 billion or $2 trillion bull run. And it's just before the COVID correction, which was, I mean, as we now know, one of the most violent and severe pullbacks in recent history. And if that's not a testament to, you know, what news outlet you can trust. And here's the problem. It's who owns these news outlets, who owns the media outlets. And that's what we need to go and look at. It's because they're all sort of writing on an agenda, right? So it depends on who owns me and what is my agenda that I'm pushing. If you think people like the New York Times that have an agenda, of course they have an agenda. You only have to look at FTX and what happened there with the amount of news outlets that were publishing favorable articles about him, even in the wake of, you know, all the revelations that came out. It's because he paid them to write puff pieces. I'm not going to go and name names of the publications, but you can go and trace them back for yourself. The Block was one that had to come out, and sort of the CEO had to come out and apologize and say, hey, the CEO took loans from FTX, right? And Alameda to sort of do stuff. And I mean, they are all big crypto news and research site. So then it becomes, oh, what is the conflict of interest? If they all those years wrote only good things about him and VCs bought or VCs piled money into FTX based on all that press and all that good, because just go back and see, there was almost never any negative thing about Sam and FTX and Alameda Research. So I'm a firm believer that news is noise. In the financial world, we look at technical analysis, and we look at fundamentals, and we look at the macro picture, and whatever the news media wants to say or wants to write, I take it with a pinch of salt, because I firmly believe that it's put there to confuse the masses, and it's doing a very good job of it.
I see. So where do you go and get your information, like sources? Like, is there like a few sources, or is it just a whole hundreds of sources? Like, how do you go about finding the information that's you think is pertinent, important, and more factual? And what is your process when you go, like, you're writing some articles and doing your trading? Like, how do you get what you need, and where do you go?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So for articles, I guess that's the first point of call. Articles, as we try to use like firsthand sources, right? That's always your best, people that have firsthand knowledge. But Twitter is an amazing resource if you know how to do your own research, because we always say sort of, do your own research, but how do you do your own research? And that's really through comprehension and understanding, because I feel like these days we read a lot, or some of us read a lot, but do we really understand, and can we apply what we read, and can we decipher what is nonsense and what is not? And that's the next sort of big skill set, I think, important skill set. It's having that skill to sort of decipher. Elon might put out a tweet and say, okay, this, whatever. And then you have to go and literally do your own research and check, is this factual or not? And sometimes it can be hard, but I think the more you sort of do it, I mean, I didn't go to journalism school, so there might be a right way and a wrong way to do it, but I just feel that all the information in the world is out there, right? It's discerning what is true and what's not. So that's the one part. In terms of the markets, like I said, I tend to look at charts a lot, just because I always say that charts are the ultimate truth, because stories and narratives can be manipulated. But chart patterns and trains repeat just because of human history, and it's always been the same. If you go back since like the 70s and 80s, there's nothing really new in the financial markets. It's just the pace at which things are moving that have become quicker. And then something like earnings are really important. Your FOMC meetings are as well, have become like large market movers. So the best strategies are always the simplest. You only need like one or two, or need to look at one or two and three trading strategies to really sort of be successful. And but then comes the difference between trading and investing, and people like to confuse the two with each other. Not maybe they like to, but it's just that it sort of happens, because I feel that we're using the two terms interchangeably these days. You'll find someone saying they're talking about investing, and then they take a 1 year time period, and I'm like, but you can't like call 1 year investing. You know what I mean? So the time frames that we're using have become smaller and smaller. And I think there was an article a couple of weeks ago that said like it's the shortest any positions have ever been held since like forever, right? So people buy a stock, they keep it for 6 to 9 months, and they get rid of it. This whole notion of 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, it's very fast. It's going out of the window very fast. So if you really want to, so if like to summarize, if you really want to go and find out, there are great sites like Investopedia, for instance, that teaches you how to sort of do those research. And I would also go and follow a couple of guys on Twitter and LinkedIn is a great source. Just see who's putting good content out there and sort of help you in the right direction.
That's good background, Rocco. So sounds to me that I think everyone has to kind of go on their own journey and just seek out the information, not have it maybe spoon-fed. And you also kind of talk about, like, you know, looking at the numbers. So maybe there's a saying that this famous fictitious doctor says, numbers don't lie. So maybe a more of a reliance on that, but not exclusively just on that, but to seek out other sources. So it's interesting. You made those comments about investing, like the way we kind of do it, maybe it's kind of changing. Mm-hmm. And that kind of leads into my next kind of topic here. Because in the traditional sense, where I used to, you know, work in the industry, where it's like, you know, we talk about these 60-40 portfolios, where it's constructed with, you know, 60% equities, 40% bonds, and long-term investing, you kind of mentioned that it might be going out the window. And I kind of agree with you, because everything is, the time frames for what is long term is being redefined each and every day. Before it was, yeah, maybe 10 years, now it's down to 1 year maybe as long term. And I just kind of curious, it's like all those conventional wisdoms that, you know, other great investors have said, and for us to kind of take their mantras, you know, to heart with our investing approach, I think we have to kind of look at that with a more critical lens, and maybe we have to change our approach, because everything to me, it sounds like the financial world is structured where it's based on algorithmic trading. There's a lot of big money that moves markets, and it's just based on whatever, let's say, the US Federal Reserve does with their interest rate policies, maybe some macro things here and there, listening off a few indicators, but buying and holding, you know, looking at the traditional metrics, I think that sounds like it's kind of out the window. Just curious, what is your take?
Yeah. How do you know if a company is going to exist for 10 years or 15 years? How do you know if a company is still going to be around, right? It's not like Coca-Cola. If you look at Buffett's, I mean, people always use Buffett as sort of the gold standard. But my argument, and I'm a big fan of Buffett, and I don't have a problem, but my thing is, he's an outlier, right? It's not Buffett and, it's Buffett. and he's an outlier, and we're all supposed to just copy him, and then it will all miraculously everything work out. It's not how life works. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been having this conversation. I'm a big fan of combining long-term with sort of a short-term approach. So yeah, you can still buy and hold, but look at using something like options to hedge against bad years like we had last year, where it was very clear that we were the world economy was over leveraged and there was due for a massive pullback, and the Fed sort of were far behind the eight ball. I mean, that was one of the most telegraphed moves in recent history. It's not hard to take a hybrid approach going forward to say, okay, cool, I've got this basket of, if it's an ETF, I'm a massive fan of ETFs. I think they make things very easy, but also just look at smaller positions, short or long, just incorporate trading into your investment strategy, but not like heavy leveraged. I'm not talking about day trading or something. I'm talking about if there's a sudden supply or demand shock to the system, then at least you're protecting your downside, because you don't know. I don't know what your time in the market is. Right. So we would say your time in the market, sure, but your time in the market for me, I'm 38. I still got, I'm until 50, 60. So I'm not worried. Whatever happens now, I'm not too worried because there's a lot of time. But if you are 50 or you're 55, then I'd be kind of worried about this decade that we're going into now. And if I sort of need those funds at 60 and I'm not sure what the returns are going to be if they're not actively managed. Because we, in the past, we could have sort of relied on passive management to and just like sort of forget. But now it's becoming quite evident that, oh, like you said, and you hit the nail on the head, algorithmic trading, hedge funds, they all move the market, and you're at the will of everything. And if you're not like super keen or involved in your portfolio, then you're gonna have some very difficult questions at the end of it, and you're not going to be able to actually do anything. That's why I tell people, educate yourself in the financial markets. Not necessarily that you can, I'm not advocating everyone to go and manage their own money, because it's not easy, point number one, but it's also not what everyone wants to do, right? But so then when you sit down with your financial advisor, or you want to find a financial advisor, you know what questions to ask them, and you can ask them, why are you doing this, and what are your fees, and what are your hidden fees, and just like those, that type of things. Because I feel like too many people are just blasé with, oh, I've got someone looking after my portfolio, and making a false assumption that sort of they have their best interest at heart, where in reality they're working for a fee. If you're putting your money into BlackRock or Vanguard or whatever it is, my friend, you're not even a drop. You would know. You're not even a drop in a bucket. You don't figure, right? So at least, like, going forward, I think financial literacy, we've gone through this period of awakening, I guess, in terms of financial literacy. Yes, there's a lot of nonsense online, but also it's great that people are waking up and saying, oh, I need to learn what a stock is. I need to learn what margin is. I need to learn what dividends are. And that's great at the end of the day.
Yeah, thanks for your take, Rocco. So I think there's two things that I kind of get out of what you were just saying there. So I think one is that I think we have to kind of accept that the reality has kind of changed in the whole financial world. You know, what's the makeup of it? And we've got to Yeah, just really understand it's changed and we need to adjust our way of thinking. And the second one is financial literacy. Like we have to take a hold of learning of what's going on, the days of just letting your financial advisor do their thing. I think it's kind of gone because of the changes in the dynamics in the world. So I guess if you left it with your financial advisor, I mean, that's fine, but things have changed and how are asking them the questions on how things have changed and how you can adapt to it. Like, I think we all owe it to ourselves for a stronger financial future to be asking that. Is that fair to say that those are probably the two main takeaways?
That is my two main takeaways, because like I said, it's not in everyone's best interest to manage their own money, but it's in your best interest to educate yourself. That's it.
So Rocco, let's turn now to your other area of expertise, which is the decentralized world of finance and the cryptocurrency space. I'd like to start off getting your take on this whole area, because it's, I guess the thing that pops into my head is we're talking about investments and how to, you know, diversify, how to, you know, make a better, stronger portfolio for your financial future. But is diversifying mean maybe we have to diversify away from the traditional financial world and maybe look at the decentralized world at some point? Does that need to be what we call an allocation in your portfolio? Just wondering, yeah, what are your thoughts on that? Because you got real estate, bonds, stocks, and maybe, you know, cryptocurrency or some kind of digital assets in the future as it emerges. Wondering what your thoughts are.
So I think that's a billion-dollar question, right? Because no one knows. And because we don't have enough data. So the narrative was that Bitcoin is digital gold. Bitcoin is a hedge against inflation. Both of those things have been proven untrue. Look at where the level it came from, $69,000-$70,000 to where it's now. No investable asset class should, and I don't care what anyone says, no investable asset class should perform in that way. No fund manager or hedge fund manager will go near it if it's that volatile. So if we, I don't care for the price that it's trading. If it's trading like in the price range that it's now and stable, and it's stable for a couple of years, yes, then we can sort of go and look at allocating 1%, 2%, 3%, 4%, 5%, right, to something like Ethereum or Bitcoin, but not in this current sort of volatility. That's speculation, right? So if there are loads of guys, I mean, I missed the Bitcoin boat, but many guys that put like 50K into Bitcoin when it was worth nothing and then became sort of quote unquote crypto millionaires. That is not the case anymore because people lost a lot of money now because they use leverage to trade crypto. And that's my number one rule, is you don't use leverage to trade crypto because of the volatility. I've seen people lose everything that they had and they made. So in terms of diversifying into crypto right now as in terms of an investment, that's a no from me. Trading, yeah, you can trade it, but just at low margin because it's very volatile. But is there, that's a debate currently. It's like if you can't say with surety that something is going to go to zero, then you have to start putting a probability on it that it's the price is going to go up, that it's investable. And it depends on where we go 2023 2024. I think by 2025 we'll sort of know, because we would have gone through that massive pullback and see what it's done, because it might be, and I'm only speculating here, but it might be that that massive bump that we saw might have been sort of not a real like inflation of value of sorts, and that the real value is closer, or even we haven't reached the the real value, even if it's lower than what it is now. But if it's stable for a couple of years, then we can start looking at sort of attaching a percentage to a portfolio. But as far as any other cryptocurrency, I don't see anything past Ethereum or Bitcoin at this stage. Yes, there are great projects out there on blockchain, but as a pure as a currency, no, I'm not seeing anything at the moment.
Thanks for sharing that, Rocco. So we're talking about Bitcoin. I wanted to kind of dive into that a little bit further. I mentioned what happened with FTX, and I think that's been well documented. This whole thing is being, it's an ongoing discovery of what's really happened there. But I
crazy
think
story.
It's very, very crazy. And I think it's also a good point just to be balanced on this too, for people to understand in this whole industry that there's things like crypto, there's things like Bitcoin, and then there's things like an exchange. Those are all different things. A lot of people get these things misconstrued, whereas like Bitcoin, it's like a technology, a decentralized way to store value. And there's a limited supply of 21 million, from what I understand. So the concept is hard to grasp because it's counter to what our current financial system, what we call the fiat currency system, where the governments around the world, they basically, you can inflate the currency supply, and they've been doing that for decades and even more so the last few years. So yeah, I guess my next question to you is that whether or not Bitcoin is the part of the future in some degree or not, what do you think of the current financial system, as is? Can this carry on with the system that we have? We're seeing a lot of cracks. And can Bitcoin be part of the future, or maybe it's something else?
I think that's a brilliant question. And I think we're starting to see countries like Brazil and Turkey, and especially up in Africa, have started using Bitcoin, not because they want to, but because they need to. They don't have another choice, because their central banks and the governments have failed them. So they see something that you would be familiar with called hyperinflation, where your money effectively becomes worthless. So they buy Tether and stable coins and stuff like that, and trade with it just to sort of survive. And I think that's where the foothold right becomes apparent. It's in the absence of a strong local currency, especially something pegged to the dollar, we're going to see countries sort of moving in that direction, just as an alternative to the people, because there is you can't like operate in your own local currency. You need to have like bags of cash to go and buy bread and stuff like that, which is crazy. I think that's where Zimbabwe is another one where we're seeing a strong surge in cryptocurrency being traded. Is it sustainable? That's an interesting question, because it's been sustainable. It's not been great, but it's been sustainable for so many years since the depegging of the gold standard. But modern money, what's it called, MMT, modern money monetary theory, effectively, I don't think it works. I think it's broken. I don't think it's going to be replaced at some stage by something. It looks like central bank digital currency at this stage. For all the trials that I've seen ran by Singapore, for instance, are running trials. It's been active in China for a couple of years, I think 1 or 2 years now. And it's just a way for government to basically put more structure and more power into currency, which is frightening. Because imagine that they control, all those controls that you spoke about, imagine if they control it even more. So there will be a cry for an alternative, right? If Bitcoin is that alternative, I do not know. I do not know if something else will come along and be that alternative, but we need something else that is not manipulated by governments and by central banks. But I don't know what that is, because for me personally, Bitcoin has too many flaws, right? It's too open for manipulation. If you look at the price of Bitcoin moving in lockstep with something like not something, but it's moving in lockstep with the Nasdaq. Why is it doing that? If it's truly a decentralized currency, right, and it's not open for manipulation, then why is it mimicking the movement of the Nasdaq? That's some questions that I have that some of the smartest minds out there couldn't really give me an answer. Maybe someday someone will, you know, say something that makes sense, but until then, there are too many uncertainties. Like I said in the beginning, an asset class should not move like that from those levels where it was to where it's now. We would expect it to be far more stable. What's interesting to me is, it's like if I use Bitcoin, and if I were to use Bitcoin now, and I want to go out and pay for stuff, then the amount of places that would actually accept it are so limited that as a currency, it's actually useless. I'm just talking about South Africa now. So it's slowly moving towards trials. One of our local retailers, one of the largest retailers, have started a trial accepting Bitcoin as payment, which is great, because I think now then we can sort of see, okay, cool, what is the appetite? How does it work? And yes, you can. There are Visa cards and MasterCards where you can put Bitcoin on and use it as a sort of a payment where it gets settled at the back end in fiat. But that's not real crypto decentralization. That's just a conversion transaction. What I'm talking about is having your wallet paying in Bitcoin and then at the back end being settled in Bitcoin. Right. So we'll see how that goes. And I think my summary would be, we need more time here. I'm not a crypto maximalist, but I'm also not a skeptic. I'm sort of somewhere in between. I think the fact that the major investment banks, JP Morgan, who else? Goldman came out and said that blockchain has value, right? Tells me that there is value in the technology, but in the cryptocurrency, I'm not sure. I think time will tell.
I think that's a good way to put it. Time will tell. And from what I've noticed, tech stocks, people were saying when tech stocks came out, the volatility that happened, it was crazy. And then there's still obviously volatility now, but over time, that kind of gets smoothed out on a chart. So perhaps the same may happen with Bitcoin or whatever the next thing is. And you were mentioning, I think, the application of using Bitcoin in different like stores to buy and sell things is key. So I guess it's almost like a chicken and egg argument. It's like, how can it be adopted if people don't try to adopt it? And it can't be adopted if people don't. So whatever it is, again, we're experimenting with Bitcoin, but it could be something else. So whatever the new alternative is, and this is my next question here, it's like, so if it wasn't Bitcoin, wasn't something else, one thing that's being currently developed by what we call these BRICS nations, a number of countries around the world that we got, I think South Africa is part of it, Russia, China, they want to develop their India. Own currency, India, all these other ones, the major commodities behind them, and they want to maybe link it up to gold or some other kind of thing. Is that potentially maybe the other thing that's on the background that might be used as a method of currency for the new thing that happens in the future? Just wondering what your thoughts are as you're someone in that one of those nation groups.
they've been talking about an African coin for I don't know how many years, maybe 5 to 10 years. Nothing's happened. I know BICS again, they're talking. But so my problem is that you don't have to go very far to see things like this not succeeding. Look at the euro, right? The euro is it's not, I mean, look where it was and look where it's now. And the problem is that countries are, even though they might be aligned, they're so fundamentally different that I don't know see how they can sort of coexist on a currency level. If you take our economy and India and China and Russia, it's hard. Yeah, they might be able to pull it off, but just globalization is dying. So that's the one thing, is that we're not as integrated as we once were. So if there was a chance, we might have missed the boat on that. Even I see countries adopting their own digital currencies and running with that, building in stuff like social credit scores, playing with interest rates in a new way we haven't seen before. And I think more likely to see that than countries unifying under one currency.
Thanks for your share there, Rocco. That's an interesting topic, all these new things. And I want to end off our discussion about new things out there with NFTs. Like the magazine you wrote for is NFT Magazine. I think a lot of people, and myself, I'm not too clear on NFT. I think conceptually I kind of get it. And I'm just wondering, perhaps you can just share like high level, like what is an NFT, non-fungible token? Like what is it, and what's the practical use for it? Because it's one of these new things that kind of came out the last couple of years. So I wonder if we can just tap into your expertise on this one.
I think I want to start, like with any new technology, right? There is great promise and then there is a hijacking of that promise, right? And I think that's what happened with NFTs in essence, because if you look at the what it is, a digital smart contract, where you can set all the parameters with code, and basically that technology, and that is stored on the blockchain, so it's verifiable. That technology became hijacked by your influencers, like your Logan Pauls and Gary V's, and not that Gary's a bad person, but I'm just saying that it became hijacked to a point where people like Justin Bieber and Snoop Dogg were used to pump aboard a yacht club from Yuga Labs, and came out now and said, oh, but they were actually paid to do that, right? And it became sort of a pump and dump scheme, and which I'm sort of glad that is out of the way now, or it's getting out of the way, and those people are getting exposed, because NFTs really have, if you look at the digital contract side, concert ticketing and sports ticketing and real estate and healthcare, those are all things that NFT technology can be used for. It's not as sexy and as headline grabbing as an artist selling an image for $69 million. But technology at the very best is often very boring. And I think once we start seeing these boring applications coming through, then all this hype around artists using it for nefarious purposes will sort of die down, if that makes sense.
And it's interesting you're talking about artists. So the one piece of this where I think I kind of understand like the use case for NFTs is, like if you have a artwork piece like $70 million and you don't have $70 million, but you want to own a piece of this, and somehow
fractional ownership.
So that's one of the main, I guess, key points of using NFTs. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, no, it is. But the problem, well, what happened, what can happen and what happened there is that the valuation becomes inflated due to wash trading practices. And then people got scammed out of a lot of money because they were led to believe that something is worth something that it's not. And at the end of the day, it's, I'd rather, let me put it like this. So something is only as valuable as you can sell it to the next person. So if I say this NFT is worth $100, then it is dependent on another person giving me $100 or $101 and me accepting it. That's the contract. If no one wants to, then that effectively becomes worthless. But I'm more keen on the sort of the utility side, right, of using NFTs. If I go to a NFL game and that and my season ticket or my game pass comes in form of an NFT and it gives me extra added bonuses or entrances or get scanned or I can download things or I can, you know, whatever, do something sort of a memorabilia and that becomes worth more. I'm sort of more in that camp to say, okay, that's something that sounds like more feasible than paying $50,000 for an image.
Thanks for that overview, Rocco. So hopefully that helps people get up to speed a little bit about what that is. You know, like you were saying earlier, we got to educate ourselves. So yeah, this is the start of that journey for all of us. So yeah, thanks again for that. So I want to turn to a couple of social media bits that I want to get your take on. In your LinkedIn profile, you mentioned a little something here. I want to read this out here. It's like you describe yourself as someone that sees trends before they happen. So I gotta ask, like, what are the trends that you're seeing? And we're just kind of curious to see how they're going to extrapolate out in the future.
So Q1 is usually where I sort of start. I wish I had an answer for you now, but usually it's post Q1. So I'm going to say check back later, because Q1 is where everything sort of in the financial markets start to settle down. Even if you look at 2021 and 2022, that sort of post Q1, the trend was very obvious. But there's a lot of noise at the moment in the financial markets that need to subside. But if you look outside of financial markets and to tech, obviously, ChatGPT-3 is a massive one, generative AI. I think it was about 6 months ago, now to this day, I talked about AI with a guy called Derek Watson, who is... he hates it when I call him a VC guy, but he's a VC. I just call him a VC guy there in Dubai. And we talked about AI and sentient AI and the use cases and stuff before everyone really was talking about it. So sort of when I say I see trends before they happen, it's just like sort of picking up on stuff or little things and saying, okay, what's maybe going to have momentum and what is just a lot of noise. But generative AI, like from 6 months ago, I said, oh, this is going to be a big thing. And then ChatGPT-3 basically launches and it becomes this all-encompassing trend. I mean, you if it's LinkedIn, if it's Twitter, if it's Instagram, people are using ChatGPT-3 to write hooks. People are using it to generate captions, generate whole articles, generate anything that you can imagine. And I think it's going to fundamentally change the way that we create content. But then if we'll have to see when ChatGPT-4 comes out, to what extent we move forward. But for me, the big thing is going to be when ChatGPT, right? Or any AI model, because there's going to be other people that are building. Google is working on one that they want to launch. So it's not like OpenAI has the sort of the monopoly on it. There are other models that are going to come out. Once we have a model that's hooked up to the internet or is able to be hooked up on the internet. So for those that don't know, GPT-3 is learned on a massive data set up until September 2021, I think. Past that, it doesn't have any information. Also, if you ask them about current people, it can't go onto the internet and go and check. So it can't like grab that information. Once that is done, that's going to be the absolute game changer, because then we're talking about, it's like a living, breathing Wikipedia thing with, and if it's going to have consciousness, I'm having this debate almost every week. It's like, we don't even know what consciousness is. We don't know how it operates. We don't know how it manifests. So this, all we know is this thing is learning like a child, right? So it's learning through input. If I've got my one son is 4, the other one is 2. So how they learn is input. They don't go and they don't read and then they sort of process. They listen to my voice, all right, and the words, and then they learn, because otherwise they would have read and then, you know what I get, what I'm saying. So we are basically informing ChatGPT now by putting in lots of stuff and seeing how it deals with it and how it grows. So ultimately, in theory, you would be able to upload future iterations into a humanoid, which is just like a fancy word for a robot, and then get it to schedule tasks in a warehouse. Like Amazon would be able to replace all their workers in a warehouse with humanoids loaded with AI software and basically just work on inputs, which is an absolutely scary thought. But given you just said about, you know, workers,
job shortages. I'm already, right, lining this up here. So basically, that's a solution for some companies, that we got answering service that is ChatGPT or whatever GPT version. Yeah, they're going to take the job, I guess.
And we're moving at such a scary pace, right? Like breakneck pace. Because I was skeptical about it before I tried it, because and I was like, yeah, it's like, because there were things like Jarvis and sort of services that you could for fun put an input and it writes a stuff. But then it gets to a point where you start playing with it, and honestly, if you haven't played around with it, I implore everyone, do not get into a position where you get left behind on this, right? So Web3, Metaverse, blockchain, those are all things that I don't necessarily believe it's here and now. It's going to be stuff in the future. So you can still sort of, there's time, but generative AI, if you don't know how to use GPT-3 and you're not familiar with the input and what it can do, it's going to get exponentially away from you. And it's not like in the coming months, whatever GPT-4 has in store, you don't want to be that old person, and not necessarily, you don't even need to be old, you know what I mean? It's like, you don't want to be that person that, when the stuff comes out, it's like having to work a computer for the first time, or I don't know how to use a mobile, or I don't know how to access the internet. And I honestly believe that generative AI is that next step for us to sort of get to the point where we start interfacing with data in a real time. It's exciting and scary at the same time.
I think that's a good way of putting it. Exciting and scary at the same time. And I think that goes back to our couple of takeaways. Like, we've got to accept that that's a reality. This thing is going to continuously evolve and accelerate the evolution process. And we've got to learn more about it. The financial literacy for all of us, like you, I, everybody's got to learn more to see. Otherwise, we don't want to get left behind on whatever the new thing is that integrates, you know, this ChatGPT or some AI into our daily lives. I think that's probably pretty key.
Can you imagine if we do get to a point where companies like Neuralink, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, put a chip in your brain and can upload a version of ChatGPT 10. I don't know. I'm just speculating here. It's like getting a bit sci-fi, but and overnight, you know everything about everything. It's something straight out of a sci-fi, but I don't think we're that far away.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting you say that. So talking about Neuralink, this is one of Elon's kind of babies. And that's kind of my next question here. A little observation I had on your Twitter. Every day you've been bugging Elon to come on your podcast. So just a real fun question here. So is this all about being persistent and you're going to keep doing this until one day he comes on? And hey, if he comes on, yeah, let me know. And I'm going to definitely listen in on that podcast episode. So just wondering what your thoughts on your process there.
Yeah, so it became sort of a rib at the start. I was on a podcast called Motion, and this guy described his way of getting Gary Vee to obviously Gary Vee is a big name in the content generation game, to come onto his podcast. And I said, okay, cool. So what principles do you have that you can share with me if I want to get Elon? Because for me, Elon is a very interesting person. He's South African. I would love to ask him hard questions, not necessarily lowball questions. Oh, Elon, you're so great. And, you know, stuff like that. I'm like, Elon, do you seriously think that we're going to get to Mars? Is that the right move to make? And stuff like that. You know what? Serious questions. And he said just, so Elon likes memes. He likes to retweet memes. He likes to, you know, whatever. So, and then like, okay, cool. Let's just create a meme every day and tweet it at him. I think we're at day 167 or 68. No response from Elon as yet. I really enjoyed the process this far because we've gotten a lot of people that sort of reach out, and it's a bit of an inside joke at the moment. So one day, if Elon comes on and it does work, then we'll sort of know. But honestly, I don't know. It's just but again, if in an infinite timeline, anything is possible. So it's just like, if you're persistent enough, I really do believe if you pitch up every day, you'll eventually get what you want at the end of the day. And I want Elon on the podcast to ask him the hard questions.
Sounds good. Yeah, keep up the persistency, Rocco. I'll give you a follow there. I'm eagerly awaiting that day there. So as we wind down this podcast, I always ask a two-part question to all my guests, and it goes like this. What are you most grateful for, and what are you most looking forward to in the future?
What am I most grateful for? I would guess for me, on a personal level, it's family. Because someone once told me that even if it's going good or bad and you feel like you've got nothing left or no one cares and you're all alone, if you've got family, you're still surrounded by people that love you irrespective of what's going on. So that's something that I'm very grateful for. Then excited for the future. I'm excited to see where civilization goes. I'm excited to see what we become and what we accomplish. Because if you look throughout history, we've gone through enormous strife, right? We've gone through famine and death and plagues, but we've survived. We might not like ourselves, we might not like what the world is now, but I'm telling you, and this is sort of a hobby historian, we're in a much better place than we were in the medieval times and you know, going back even further than that. So all the periods where we've gone through tough time, we've came out better and stronger as a human race. I believe that the technology and the medical advancements we'll see now in the coming years will put us in a different stratosphere. And we sort of just have to keep a cool head here. We have to keep our cool and say, okay, cool. This is a cycle that we're going through. Pretty much if I would have to guess, a 10 to 15 year cycle of things that it's going to be tough. But if we get to the other side, then and we've sort of got our families and we've got our health, then we'll be good. And I'm excited to see what's on the other end. We have to be optimistic at in times like these, right? Because what is the use of being a pessimist and not looking forward to tomorrow?
Those are some great words to leave us off with, Rocco. So if people want to know more about you, where can they find you?
The best place is LinkedIn. LinkedIn is my home. Just search for Rocco Stradom. And then if you want to go check out the SGM podcast, wherever good podcasts are found. And if you want to go and check out my writings, go and check out NFT Today magazine. I write blockchain and Web3 predominantly. Yeah, there's all the places to find me.
Thanks, Rocco. We'll be sure to add those to our show notes. So that's a wrap for episode 11. Thanks for joining us and namaste, everyone.